This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's California Politics Today. We're about to speak to Dave Jones, who's a California Assemblymember from District 9. Welcome to Utopia Media's California Politics Today.
Thanks, Mark.
What was your role in today's informational hearing about stem cell research intellectual property?
I chair the Assembly Judiciary Committee, and in that capacity I was a joint chair of the hearing today, along with the Assembly Committee on Health and the Senate Committee on Health.
Okay, and what was the purpose of this hearing, and what exactly were you as the chair of the committee trying to co-chair of that committee trying to find out?
We had several goals today, one of which was to hear from experts regarding how we can best ensure the broadest distribution of the treatments and therapies that come out of the $3 billion investment that taxpayers are making in stem cell research.
Okay, and what did the people who testified say overall?
Well, we had a number of witnesses critical of a report that was prepared by the California Commission on Science and Technology,
Were those people there? Did they present their report?
Yes, they did.
And what was the gist of their report, well, before we go into the criticism of
certainly
it?
Certainly. The gist of the CCST report was that the state should not seek to obtain royalties or seek to use or place limitations on the intellectual property from stem cell research that would help ensure the broadest distribution of that research to you know, not only people who have an ability to pay, but to people that don't have health care insurance or don't have an ability to pay.
Who is the California Council on Science and Technology? Where do they come from? How did they get into the act exactly?
Well, they're a group of scientists and engineers and academicians, as well as some representatives of the private sector, who advised the state legislature generally on science and technology. And they were asked by the legislature to look at the question of how we can best ensure the broadest public benefit from the $3 billion investment we're making in stem cell research.
That was ACR 24.
That's right. And that resolution, ACR 24, was very specific with regard to the sorts of things we wanted them to look into, including revenue sharing, royalties, pricing, and other mechanisms to ensure that there was some public benefit, since all taxpayers are having to shoulder the burden here. I think our concern in the legislature was that the treatments and therapies that come out of the stem cell research are made available to the broadest number of people.
And again, then, how did the CCST address those issues? What were its recommendations?
Well, in my view, they weren't terribly thorough in looking at the issues that the legislature asked them to look at, and a number of other witnesses at the hearing confirmed this. Generally, their recommendation was that the state should not seek to use restrictions on intellectual property or limitations on intellectual property or conditions on intellectual property coming from stem cell research as a way of ensuring accessibility and affordability of the therapies and treatments that come out of stem cell research. They advocated for adherence to the Bayh-Dole Act, which is a federal act that gives universities the right to patent and license the intellectual property so as to make it available to the private sector for commercialization. And it made some suggestions on some modest ways to improve Bayh-Dole, but really didn't address some of the more fundamental criticisms that were raised by other witnesses today with regard to how Bayh-Dole has been working.
Okay, could you recount some of those criticisms and tell us who made them?
Yes, there were several criticisms raised with regard to how the Bayh-Dole Act has affected innovation and research in the United States. One criticism, which was shared by several of the witnesses, has to do with what's been referred to as the patent thicket. which is essentially the way in which universities and university researchers and affiliated industries are patenting almost every conceivable discovery or therapy or outcome of research in a way that makes it very, very difficult then for other scientists to use those discoveries or that research information in their own research.
And that's somehow been established as a problem with Bayh-Dole nationally already.
Yes, I mean, that's one of the criticisms of Bayh-Dole. Bayh-Dole authorizes and, in fact, really encourages the patenting and licensing of university discoveries.
And why is that likely to be a problem in terms of stem cell research in California?
Well, because we're really at the beginning, and just as it's been a problem in other areas in biomedicine and biotechnology, the concern is that if discoveries get tied up in exclusive licensing agreements and exclusive patents, it'll be nearly impossible, if not impossible, for other scientists to use those discoveries in a way that will advance the general cause of stem cell research.
Is that patent thicket problem manifest itself in that it's just too complicated to figure out who owns all the underlying patents, or a lot of the owners of the underlying patents tend to want exorbitant licensing fees for letting them be used, or both?
I think it's both and more. I think it's the transaction costs associated with figuring out who owns what, and then jumping through all the hurdles to try to get permission to use what they have discovered, and also in some cases exorbitant fees have been sought in order to use the discovery.
Okay, now did any of the witnesses propose solutions to the patent thicket problem?
Yes, and the patent thicket problem actually is one of several problems that were identified. The other is just a broader decline in significant discoveries coming out of the biotech and biomedicine industry, and this was attributed in part to the difficulty in getting access to basic science to do further research. Some of the suggestions were as follows. One is something called patent pooling,
okay,
which involves taking the discoveries, and instead of having the universities or research institutes own them and then patent them and then license them to others, have a third-party nonprofit or institute pool all of the discoveries that are funded from the Proposition 71 infusion of $3 billion and make those patents available in a non-exclusive way, allow the commercialization of those patents and the commercialization of that intellectual property, but do so in a way that isn't exclusive. So that means that other scientists can get at the information, can use it in their own research and advance the general cause of making improvements and discoveries, but as well commercial entities could obtain a license to use the information and commercialize it and get it out into the market. So it's a way of trying to have the best of both worlds.
So essentially you'd create something called more or less the California Stem Cell Patent Pool Foundation or Institute, and it would own the patents.
That's but, right.
And it would share them among all the researchers funded by the ICOC, CIRM, Proposition 71.
Or anybody else for that matter. I mean, that's the genius of it. I mean, we really want to rely on the best and the brightest across this nation and across the world. And in fact, that's one of the geniuses of American science is the way in which our scientific discoveries are open and shared, and there's communication among and between scientists. I mean, contrast that to the Soviet Union and its scientific challenges by virtue of having a closed system in which information was not shared.
So, in fact, what you're saying is, in addition to resolving issues involving stem cell research in California, you're essentially trying to get back to or create a kind of golden age of information sharing among scientists, unencumbered by patent thickets.
Well, I'm not going to suggest that we can do that just through this one effort.
Right.
But I am saying that there's a problem right now with the way in which the Bayh-Dole Act is being implemented, and at the very least, we ought not to replicate that problem as we implement Proposition 71.
Okay, and that patent pool then would be empowered to license the collectivity of discoveries or the results or essentially end results to commercial entities to apply it and then get money that would come back to the pool, which would be divided by the pool according to some complex and arcane formula, depending on who contributed what to the end result.
Yeah, that's one possibility, or another, if the concern is that doesn't generate enough revenue for private sector commercial entities to be interested, then maybe what you do is you allow licensing to occur, but again, not exclusive licensing, and then you allow the commercial entities to compete amongst each other, and they can try to make as much money as the market will allow them without necessarily sharing the money back. I mean, there's a variety of variations on this.
Is cross-patenting one of them?
Well,
or is that something different
that
entirely?
Cross-patenting didn't come up in the hearing, but another thing that did come up is something called march-in rights.
Okay.
MARCH-IN rights, and that is a right that exists under the Bayh-Dole Act that allows federal agencies to intervene when a licensee isn't moving the discovery to market and is basically hoarding it and just sitting on it.
Right.
But the unfortunate fact is that the NIH, the National Institute of Health, has never exercised the march-in rights granted under the Bayh-Dole Act, nor has any other federal agency for that matter. So one suggestion was to make, and that's largely because of the procedural hurdles that the Bayh-Dole Act places in terms of using march-in rights. So a suggestion in the context of Prop 71 was that we make it easier for the state to exercise march-in rights, and if it sees that a commercial entity or a grantee or a licensee is hoarding a patent and not applying it, that there'd be an easier ability for the state, as opposed to the federal case, to intervene and then, you know, shift that discovery or patent to someone else who's then going to use it.
Okay, I want to move on to some other subjects, but I want to know how much time you've got so I can parse the...
No, we're good for 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay, good.
Depends on how much you want to talk about it. It was fascinating. It's a fascinating subject.
Right, it is. Talk about the subject, if it came up, or talk about it even if it didn't, if you want to, about the question of tax-exempt bonds being able to fund research that returns revenue to the state. Did that come up at all?
It did, and we spent a considerable amount of time on that, and I think what's most distressing about that is that the campaign for Proposition 71 and the proposition itself told the voters that the state would share in royalties or revenues coming from the $3 billion investment that the taxpayers are being asked to make in stem cell research.
Maybe I could clarify something. You've referred several times to the $3 billion investment. It's my understanding that it's going to cost $6 billion in taxpayer money to pay off the bonds to raise the $3 billion.
Yeah,
is that right?
You're right. Your figure actually is a more accurate reflection of the total cost. I'm referring to the fact that $3 billion was authorized by Proposition 71, $3 billion in bonds.
Right.
But you're absolutely correct. Once you pay the interest on those bonds, the figure gets closer to $6 billion in terms of the total cost to the general fund and the total cost to taxpayers.
And my guess is that's for tax-exempt bonds that would cost $6 billion, but the one figure that's been released recently is that to use taxable bonds is going to cost the state about $700 million more.
Yes, we received a range with regard to the potential costs associated with using taxable bonds, and it was anywhere between, say, $500 to the top-end figure you just discussed, $700 million in extra cost.
Okay.
So the disappointing thing that came out of the hearing was that this promise that was made by the campaign and in the initiative itself may not be realizable because you cannot use tax-exempt bonds and provide royalties back to the state. It's more complicated than that, but the bottom line is that there are significant restrictions on the ability to use tax-exempt bonds with a lower interest rate and therefore lower cost to the taxpayers, and simultaneously have a royalties flow back to the state. Now, there's some potential ways to work around that. that were discussed at the hearing. But one thing that is of some concern to those of us, I think, on the joint committees is that there doesn't seem to be a lot of urgency or a strong sentiment on the part of the CCST, the California Commission on Science and Technology, or for that matter, even the ICOC to explore, you know, very strongly the ways in which one might be able to work around some of these restrictions.
So does it seem that did you get a feeling or did anyone say anything specifically about whether it's the intent of the ICOC to solve the problem by selling taxable bonds and be done with it?
Well, actually, that might be the good news. The greater impression was that there was a shift away from the promise made in the initiative and in the campaign to have royalties come back to the state.
So they'll solve.
In fact, the CCST affirmatively, strongly recommended that the state not seek to get royalties back, both because of the tax exempt bond issue, but also because the CCST believes that, in essence, such royalties will inhibit the kind of research and development that they think is important under the initiative.
So in fact, the CCST's recommendations were
forget the royalties.
Sell tax exempt bonds and resolve the issue that way.
Yeah. So, but the problem is that the initiative itself, and thankfully so, says specifically that royalties and public benefits should flow back to the state unless it can be demonstrated with some evidence in each license or grant that to do so would unreasonably hinder research and development. So notwithstanding the CCST recommendation, the law in Proposition 71 directs the ICOC and the CIRM, which is the body that's implementing Proposition 71.
That's the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee and the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine.
That's correct. Directs them to seek to have a public benefit returned unless it can be shown that to do so would unreasonably hinder research and development. So that was one question I had for the CCST was, you know, why are you recommending something that's in violation of what the law on Prop 71 says?
What'd they say?
Well, we were asked to, you know, look beyond just the four corners of the law and assess the policy. And I said, well, great, but that doesn't change the fact of what the law requires.
Okay. Speaking of the law, I want to focus on an important issue here. It's my understanding that within the provisions of Prop 71 was a strongly worded statement saying that the California legislature had no power to change anything about it, about the that was in the proposition, or as far as I can tell, the activities of the ICOC for 3 years. What's your reading of the restrictions that Prop 71 placed on the legislature in regard to its oversight, and what, if anything, do you feel ought to be done in light of that?
Well, Prop 71 does place a limitation on our ability to change things statutorily. I don't believe, however, it restricts the ability to put another constitutional amendment on the ballot that would improve Proposition 71. And in fact, my colleague Senator Deborah Ortiz has proposed just that in Senate Constitutional Amendment 13, I believe the number is.
Yep.
And what that seeks to do is to ensure that the treatments and therapies and other discoveries coming out of the nearly $6 billion in investment are distributed in a way that they're affordable to people and accessible. And to me, that's really the biggest concern about this that I have currently.
Okay, before we're going to focus on that, but first I wanted to sort of wrap up what's happening with the payments to the state.
Right.
As a result of everyone's testimony and your thinking and questions and so on, where does that now stand, and where do the members of the Joint Committee come down now on what they think they're going to do in terms of having some input into the resolution of the tax-exempt versus royalties coming back to the state issue?
Well, a couple things. Number one, the state Treasurer's Office and their bond counsel are going to be submitting a letter to the IRS to try to seek clarification with regard to the IRS rules on tax-exempt bonds.
Is there a timetable on that?
Well, they're going to need to do so in fairly short order because we were told by the ICOC representative that in February of 2006, they plan to make their final decisions on what the intellectual property policy should be for the ICOC and the CIRM.
And how long does the IRS usually take to do something like that?
I don't have the answer to that, no one said that time frame was too tight, but it did occur to me that it's awfully tight.
It's Christmas season; they've got to do.
They're not doing taxes, you know. So it just struck me that that might not be reasonable. But in any event, we did get a commitment from the Treasurer's Office and from the ICOC representative that they would ask the question of the IRS as broadly as possible. When we walked into the hearing, we were told that the Treasurer's Office was going to defer to the ICOC with regard to, you know, what intellectual property policy it might wish to pursue, and then pose the question to the IRS based on that. That wasn't satisfactory to me because it seemed to me that the ICOC is looking at this whole issue very narrowly and may have even, at some level, or at least the CCST has made up its mind that we shouldn't even try to get royalties. So we were able to get a stronger commitment to ask the question as broadly as possible. Give us, you know, present the IRS a range of options as broad as possible with regard to how we might work around this tax-exempt bond question.
Was that a commitment you got from the ICOC or from the Treasurer's Office?
We got that both from the Treasurer's Office and from the representative from the ICOC.
Okay.
But I think that was progress. Second, this question will be posed to the IRS. Second, I got a commitment from the ICOC representative, Mr. James Penhuit, who chairs their task force on intellectual property, that they were going to hold additional meetings of their task force, and that they would invite invite the same views that we invited to the committee to express these different options that might be available to them with regard to intellectual property treatment. They held a meeting last week at which they just invited representatives from the industry and from CCST to present, and I wanted to encourage them to seek the broadest possible range of views on alternatives. So I thought that was a good step forward, that we got that commitment from the ICOC as well.
Okay. So, all right. Well, that's a good update. Why don't we focus now then on the question of at this point, though, it's unresolved how that issue is going to go.
It is unresolved. I think what we hope to do in the hearing today, though, was to make sure that the public and the ICOC were aware that there are a broad range of options in addition to or on top of Bayh-Dole that will ensure that the discoveries and treatments and research is shared broadly, that will ensure that it's affordable, that it's accessible, and that it's accessible to other scientists, too, as we talked about a moment ago with regard to patent pooling. To me, probably the biggest single issue is the issue of affordability.
Okay.
You know, every taxpayer is paying for this, and you know, Ms. Smith in my district, who is a person who makes very little income from her job and doesn't have health care provided by her employer, nor can she afford it, she's paying taxes for this. And so
that $6 billion comes out of the general revenue fund of the state of California.
Indeed it does. It comes out of the pockets of the Ms. Smiths and Ms. Jones and everybody across the state. And so
they are, in fact, the venture capitalists here.
Well, they are. And the question is, what is the return they're going to get?
Okay.
It's all well and good. And certainly I believe that, you know, we have a market-based system, and that's the most economically efficient system, and we want to get this research out into the market and have it be commercialized. But the problem with just doing that, with no other direction or requirement, is that those therapies and treatments are likely to be priced as high as the market will bear, and people like Ms. Smith and Ms. Jones, who are working poor people, and the other, you know, millions of Californians who don't have health care insurance aren't going to be able to afford these things that their taxes are paying for.
Who was at the hearing making that point, and was anyone there making the counterpoint?
Well, I made the point. Senator Ortiz made the point. There were witnesses from a couple of think tanks that made the point. And the answer that we got from the ICOC and CCST representative was essentially that, you know, those that's a legitimate problem, but that could best be solved by you know, subsidizing health care for those folks. Well, you know, and that really is an issue about can be best, that issue can best be done by using health care subsidies. Well, to my mind, $6 billion for stem cell research is a health care subsidy. And it's entirely appropriate for us to be looking at and urging the ICOC to consider mechanisms to ensure that when we make that $6 billion public investment, that the benefits flow in some way, shape, or form to all of our taxpayers.
Now, what proposals, if any, were floated as a mechanism for having that happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Bill and Melinda Grants Foundation is doing grant making in the amount of about $425 million for new drug therapies, essentially, for research and development in new drug therapies. And one thing that they have required of their grant applicants is that the grant applicants set forth a plan or program for how those drugs can be distributed to poor third world countries.
Are there some minimal requirements under the Gates plan?
Well, that's
plan?
What they're saying. Yeah, in order to get a Gates grant, you have to affirm that you're going to take steps to make sure that the fruits of the research that they're funding can be distributed to poor third world countries.
Are there any specific numerical targets or levels
I think they're doing it on a grant by grant case. But
right.
It's an example of a situation where there's grant making going on, where pricing is something that is explicitly at issue and is an explicit requirement of the grant.
Are we essentially talking about a sliding scale here, where it would be based on ability to pay?
Well, I think what they're talking about is some range of prices that poor people in third world countries could afford.
So you're talking about the Gates grant.
The Gates grant, yeah.
Right.
Because what's happening internationally in several contexts in the pharmaceutical industry is there are drugs that are available to help people in third world countries, but they're priced too high for any of those people to ever afford them.
Well, the issue has certainly come up. Tamiflu costs $6 a dose, and Indian companies are saying they're going to make it without talking to Roche, essentially.
Yeah. So you know, the kind of this, by analogy, the same issue exists here, where we have certain drugs and drug treatments in the United States which are patented in the exclusive province of particular companies, but that are the result of federally funded research, and those drugs and therapies are totally out of reach of ordinary people.
So what would you like to see be the requirements under for Prop 71, ICOC, CIRM, stem cell grants to address this problem?
Well, I mean that was why we were talking to the experts today. I don't have a specific proposal on this, but I think a mechanism to ensure affordability and accessibility, and that may mean specific requirements with regard to pricing, a commitment to price at a way that poor people can afford or people without health care can afford. Maybe the discoveries or treatments are kept in the public domain in some way so that you know, any number of manufacturers can produce them, and through that competition, the prices will be driven down.
So, in fact, that relates in an important way, I think, to the patent pool concept you were talking about earlier, doesn't it?
Potentially, yes.
Because if the discoveries are in a patent pool, then that patent pool can license them. It might make things simpler and more elegant. They could then license it on the basis that you've just discussed, namely that there needs to be a consideration of how underfunded people can procure those treatments.
That's right, how ordinary people can procure them. So, you know, and the CCST report, unfortunately, did not really examine any of these alternatives. And so we urge them to go back to the drawing board and look anew at this and we urged the ICOC to invite witnesses to come testify before it who could share with the ICOC some of these alternative mechanisms. The decision ultimately is going to be made by the ICOC.
Okay. That's what I want to wrap up with here is sort of who's in charge and the politics of all this. It sounds like, from what you're saying, that the ICOC and the CCST are on one side of this and the legislature is on the other. Is that fair?
I don't know if that's fair. I mean, I think we're all working on this together, but I think there are some of us who feel a more pressing need to make sure that there are mechanisms in place so that ordinary Californians can have the benefits of this $6 billion investment.
Okay, now is that where SCA 13 is going to come into play?
Well, that is certainly one mechanism to do that.
So is essentially, because I read the letter that Bob Fayer sent to Treasurer Angelides about this, and he says if SCA passes in its current form, it's not going to be good for the investments in stem cell research.
Well, I haven't seen that letter.
I'll send you the link.
But, you know, I mean, it does strike one that there are very powerful and wealthy interests that have a stake in this. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry, for example, and you know, it's...
You mean the people who are spending $80 million to say yes on 78, no on 79?
Well, they do seem to have a lot of cash lying around.
Right.
In any event, you know, from their standpoint, one could understand why they would prefer not to have any restrictions on pricing, because restrictions on pricing means they make less money.
Not to mention the slippery slope for non-stem cell treatments.
Well, there are a tremendous number of implications with regard to this. So, I mean, I think what we, you know, what we need to do is parse through the competing claims. I think that these things can be done, and they're not mutually exclusive. I believe that we can make this investment and encourage commercialization and encourage private sector investment, but also have mechanisms in place to assure the broadest availability and distribution. I think we're being presented with a false choice,
right?
One or the other.
Well, do you think that your advocacy of a more subtle solution to all the problems is going to be powerful enough as an idea to convince the decision makers at the ICOC to use it?
I take it at face value their statements today that they are listening and that they will give serious consideration. I am concerned that the CCST, in very short order, jumped to the conclusions that it did. I don't believe that they gave as much consideration to or time to or analyzed sufficiently any of these alternatives.
Are there recommendations? How important are their recommendations in this process?
Well, they're not binding, and also
it sounds to me like they're the staff of the legislature, but it sounds like they're more than that.
They're not. I mean, they're an independent body.
Right.
They're an independent body of scientists and engineers and industry representatives that exist to give advice on science and technology.
Right. But it sounds here that these are more economic preferences than they are scientific distinctions.
Yeah, I think, you know, they would argue that they believe that the markets and the economy is such that one can't do the things that we're talking about. But I don't believe. I mean, but as
do you agree with that?
Well, I don't, because I think that there were several witnesses, and there have been other studies and analyses that suggest the opposite, and I don't think those were given the amount of weight or attention they should have been in the CCST report.
Okay, let me ask a broader question. Are they going to get more? Anyone listening to this conversation will see that, but I'm wondering overall whether the resources of the people who agree with you are likely to be overmatched by the resources of the people who agree with the CCST.
Well, I would say this, that the resources of the pharmaceutical industry and even universities, which now have an economic interest in the status quo.
Right.
I mean, it, in fact, one of the witnesses pointed this out, the irony and inconsistency of university representatives that are hearing today arguing that the state shouldn't get royalties, but they nonetheless should.
Right.
That the universities have a very strong interest in the status quo. So clearly there is a lot of strong interest and a lot of power and influence, you know, behind the view that we should just keep things as they are and just use Baidol as it is and not try to do something different.
Well, how much leverage does the legislature have through SCA 13 to say, unless you do it the way we elected in the legislature feel it ought to be done, we'll write SCA 13 and we'll give it to the people and we'll enforce our preferences?
I think there's a risk there that could happen. I think the bigger issue for the ICOC is its credibility, and I said that today. I think that some folks are going to be scratching their heads saying, wait a minute, when I voted for this thing, I was told that there could be $1 billion in royalties going back to the state, and now you're telling me it's not going to be any because of some tax-exempt bond thing that you probably knew of at the time you were running this campaign on it.
Have your constituents gotten on to you about that?
Well, this has been written about in the media. Folks are talking about it. I got an email the other day from someone saying, wow, this looks like a bait and switch to me.
Does the ICOC seem to care about that kind of criticism?
Well, I think they do, and I think they should. And this is the broader point I was trying to make, and that is that ultimately the issue here is not how much power or influence the legislature has. It is the importance of ensuring that the ICOC maintain its credibility with the voters that established it in the first place. This is a lot of money, and the voters are going to have very high expectations with regard to both how it's used and how this is implemented. And I'm sure they're aware of this, that in many ways the credibility of this whole endeavor, this whole common enterprise that we've launched ourselves on, this important enterprise of trying to do significant stem cell research and find new treatments and cures, this whole endeavor could be placed at risk if careful attention is not given to ways in which to ensure that promises made to the voters are kept.
Well, do you think that the ICOC would have much credibility if it resolved these outstanding issues by saying we're going to sell tax-exempt bonds and not provide any royalties to the state, and we're going to rely on free market mechanisms of pricing to determine whether people have access to the cures that we promised them they'd have under the terms of the proposition we convinced them to vote for on a 3-to-2 ratio?
Yeah, I think that were the ICOC to ignore the concerns that we've raised at this committee hearing and that others have raised in the media and in other forums, that it would have very significant implications for their credibility with the voters.
Okay. Last question. What's going to happen next from your point of view there in the legislature? What are you going to do personally? What's the legislature going to do, if anything, as a follow-up to these hearings?
Well, a couple of things. One, we're going to be working with the Treasurer's Office and the ICOC to try to make sure that the broadest possible query is sent to the IRS with regard to the tax-exempt bonds. Two, we're going to continue to encourage the ICOC to solicit and consider the broadest number of alternatives to address the issues that you and I have just talked about, the accessibility and affordability, ensuring that research and discoveries are available to all scientists and these other things. So, we're going to be paying close attention and encouraging them to do the things that they said at the hearing that they would do. And then I think there's also SCA 13, and I would defer to Senator Ortiz, who's the author of that. But I would imagine if she felt that there wasn't sufficient movement, that she would seek to move SCA 13.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you very much for all
Absolutely.
Your work on this issue.
Thanks and for your interest in it. Now, where does this get published?
This is going to get published on the Utopia Media California Politics Today website, which people will be able to get to at www.etopiamedia.net, and then scroll down into the picture of the stem cells and click on California Politics Today, and for a while it'll be the one at the top.
Great.
And I'll send you a link as soon as it's in place.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.